Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the suburb redeemed and the end of the quarter acre dream. Or perhaps is it our panel may have different views there, perhaps. My name is Professor Lee Godden. I teach and research in the Melbourne Law School. I am an environmental lawyer with particular interests in areas such as climate change, water, and biodiversity. And I also, in the past, have taught areas such as planning law. So it's a great pleasure to chair a session such as this today, where climate change comes back to where we live. And so I think it's a crucial panel and a crucial ideas that we will be exploring here today. And the focus will be on an integrating panel where we seek to involve you, the audience, as well as hear from our panel speakers. And it's a pleasure also to particularly welcome members of the Melbourne University alumni. If you can join in this discussion, it will be great to see that contribution from alumni members as well as other members of the audience. Just a couple of housekeeping before we begin. The session is being filmed and recorded, so we would ask that mobile phones be turned off. Remember, you can save energy and energy efficiency by turning off your mobile phones, and that's perhaps appropriate for a climate change panel. What I will do is introduce each of our distinguished panel as they come to speak in more detail, but now I'd just like to introduce Dr. Peter Christoph, Professor Philip Goad, and Associate Professor Andrew May. And what we will do, as I said, is we'll have a general panel presentation, and it will be followed by a discussion. And we have a number of points of view being put by our panel members, and I will develop some points for discussion at the end of that series of presentations. We'll draw on the panel and then we'll throw it open to a moderated discussion. Can I ask, though, that your questions, when we do get to that point, be fairly brief and to the point, please, because we have a limited time frame today. Okay, I think without further ado, I will introduce our first speaker. And that's Dr. Peter Christoph. Peter has a long background in areas of environment. He teaches environmental policy and climate policy at the University of Melbourne. I had great pleasure to liaise with Peter in his climate law subject when I was the director of the Office for Environmental Programs. His was one of the most popular subjects in that program, so he has a long-standing interest in this area, and he is a member of the Faculty of Land and Environment here in the university. He's also a member of the Premier's Climate Reference Group here in Victoria and the Victorian Ministerial Reference Council on Climate Change Adaptation. In addition, as if all those qualifications and experience weren't enough, he is Vice President of the Australian Conservation Foundation and formerly an Assistant Commissioner for the Environment and wrote the first two State of the Environment reports in the 1980s and the 1990s. And those State of Environment reports are really critical for us to have a check on how we're going with climate change. And so it will be interesting to see as the State of Environment reports roll through whether in developing policy to address climate change through areas such as planning law, environmental policy and planning and design and reworking our cultural responses to climate change, whether in fact we can see those measurable improvements in those critical indicators for the environment. So, thank you, Peter.
Thanks, Lee, for that very generous introduction, ladies and gentlemen. I thought it might be appropriate to at least apologise at the start for not being an architect or an urban planner. As Lee said, I am someone who works in the area of climate policy and environmental policy. So inevitably, policy is going to be where this brief talk will come to rest. I think it's also fair to say that there's a theme that's going to run through this talk, and it's basically about chickens coming home to roost. And I'll explain how this works as we go on. But I want to make three broad points, if I may, through this very brief talk. Firstly, I think that there's a need to revalue and restore the suburbs as a site of production. Secondly, the intensifying pressures of climate change make this a real necessity. And thirdly, if we're going to achieve this change, we're going to have to challenge and address deeply entrenched institutional inadequacies and failures. I grew up in a suburb in Camberwell in the early 60s in one of those Spanish mission-style houses on a quarter-acre block. We had fruit trees, apples, oranges, lemons, quinces, plums. We had the remains of a vegetable bed, which I assiduously refused to manage, despite my father's best intentions. Almost behind our house was the Grays' place. They had a chook shed, kept us awake, used mainly for eggs. And next door was Giordano's house. I can't remember Giordano's family surname. They were Italians from Trieste. And they're the only other migrants, apart from my family, for miles around, as far as we could tell. Their backyard was this exemplary cornucopia of vegetables, tomatoes, carrots, potatoes, runner beans, zucchinis, cucumbers, whatever you could imagine. It's the sort of suburb that was well memorialised by the photographer Domenico Cozzolino in his photograph, Dad Checking Onions. By the time my family had left Camberwell in the 1980s, our part of the suburb, at least, had become a bit of a wilderness. The villa flats had taken over, four to a block. They'd surrounded us. There was concrete everywhere. The chooks and the veggies had pretty much gone. The sort of self-reliant or semi-self-reliant productivity of the suburbs, which had once been very highly valued, as was the collective action required to make this so, seemed to be in decline. Now, I've got to make it very clear to you that I'm not promoting an over-romanticised idyll of scrabbling chooks, the single milk cow, the ever-present whiff of dung. But I think the point I want to make is that since about the mid-20th century, Australia's suburbs have been converted from productive landscapes more into dormitory suburbs, especially but not only in terms of food. And the further you go out, in terms of the new suburbs, the more I think this seems to be the case. Now, again, I don't want to overstate this conversion. In Andrea Gaynor's very fine book, Harvest of the Suburbs, she points out that even in 1992, which is the last bit of data that she and I could find, half the households in Melbourne and Adelaide still produced food of some kind, and about 5% were self-sufficient in fruit and vegetables. But again, in 1992, the last bit of data available to us, home production was pretty much dominated by an elderly generation, those born between 1923 and 1937, the Depression generation. By the way, ethnicity was not a factor if you happen to come from Northcote and look at the Italian and Greek gardens out that way. Now, this broad conversion, I think, has to be understood in the context of a series of complex changes in economic and social relations. We've seen over the last 50 years, in particular, the creation of long, fragile, and probably highly unsustainable chains of production and consumption, which have provided cheap and easy access to a very wide range of goods and services as part of that phenomenon of increasingly globalised industrialisation. So in the area of energy, we've seen the development of perhaps, I think, unrealistically cheap power drawn from distant, concentrated points of generation. That, of course, in the Australian context, is the use of our abundant and also highly problematic sources of coal. We've seen water drawn from increasingly distant catchments, from within the Yarra catchment initially, then from the Thompson. Now we're talking about the pipeline project with all the controversies associated with that. And in terms of food, we've had the evolution of a global farm. Australia now imports, I think, something like $8 billion worth of food, and the rate of increase in the value, at least, of that importation is really quite alarming or interesting. In any case, I think it's fair to say, at least from my analytical standpoint, looking at climate change and its implications, that these large-scale, highly concentrated and spatially distant solutions to our demands as urbanists are no longer as attractive as before. They're generally expensive, they're usually pretty profligate in terms of energy, and they are prone to failure. Large dams, big power stations, industrialised food and other goods and services produced elsewhere and transported from afar. So let me now talk about the suburbs in terms of the climate challenge and why I think that we need to return to increasingly productive localised landscapes, a partial retreat, if you like, to the suburbs. And I think there are, well, I'd like to say that there are five reasons at least that one could talk about. These are interrelated sources of insecurity. Firstly, and this is really the overarching one, there's climate insecurity, the sort of issues that have been brought to us, and I think brought home to us very tragically early this year, in terms of the extremes of weather, extremes of heat, with the impacts on health, on transport, on demands of energy, on rainfall, changes in the longer term in sea levels, again with impacts on coastal suburbs, and also now very highly concentrated where it would be sewage farm. If one looks at the recent study by CSIRO looking at temperature increases, projected increases for Melbourne, just Melbourne alone, we notice that, again in terms of these extremes, that by the time you get to 2070, with a moderate sort of pattern of emissions reduction occurring, we'll see temperatures in Melbourne over 30 degrees go from something like 30 days of over 30 degrees Celsius to about 39 days, or even up to 50 days if emissions continue to rise at a fairly unbridled pace. The number of days over 40 degrees, and this year has been quite exceptional, on average one per year, through to about at least five by the time we get to 2070. So there are significant demands going to be put on all of these systems. Then there's the issue of, So this is a general trend that we can see looking at the long trajectories, both in terms of rainfall and also in temperature increase, patterns of change. Then more immediately and more, immediately in a cultural sense as well, we know that we are suffering from significant water insecurity, partly because of the ways in which we provide a supply for water. There have been significant changes over the last few decades in rainfall patterns. This is just an indication of the last few years, but you'll notice the reddest area are the areas of lowest rainfall on record. And the same sort of pattern goes back for about a decade or so. This, of course, has had some implications for water availability. And as we know, again, very painfully in the Victorian and the Melbournean context, there's a significant decline in inflows to our various dams and various catchments. Then there's the issue of energy security more generally. In a climate of emissions reduction need, what sort of power will we have for the future? There's a very significant reliance, as we know, on coal in Australia, in Victoria in particular. We have the problem of how we're going to transform ourselves, generate energy from different sources, and also fuels from different sources for transport. I mentioned that there are increased demands for cooling in particular. Now, the general patterns of consumption leave us with a range of forms of insecurity. I want to tie into this discussion the insecurity that comes from the prospect of peak oil. Pressure associated with the likely increases in cost and availability of oil, the growing scarcity over time of oil, including for transport, but also for agriculture and for manufacturing of various manufacturing activities and goods, which will have significant cost impacts unless effective substitution isn't found in time. And then lastly, and importantly, I think there's the issue of food security or food insecurity. We are vulnerable both in terms of climate and also supply and also in relation to the cost pressures associated with water and transport for the reasons I've already mentioned. So broadly and in all, climate change is putting us under significant pressure and our suburbs as well. In two particular ways. Firstly, there's the pressure associated with mitigation, emissions reduction. The pace with which we need to cut our emissions is severe indeed. It's about 40% by 2020, and well ahead of the sort of targets which are currently being discussed at the moment at Copenhagen. If we are to take seriously the prospects of dangerous climate change and limit our temperature increase to 2 degrees or even less globally, and close to 100% by, I think, well before 2050. So there's the mitigation problem. There's also the problem of adaptation. We're going to need to adapt to climate change if things go well. Climate is changing, there are pressures, and we'll certainly have to adapt if things don't go well in terms of emissions reductions. When you look at Australia in particular, we have built in over the last decades a very inflexible system of development, infrastructural development, in particular in relation to energy. And we've, of course, in the last decade suffered a very severe form of policy neglect in relation to energy supply and emissions provision. The point I want to make about this particular graph, which is a very complicated one, is firstly, half of our greenhouse emissions come from the provision of power, electricity, and the use of coal, and about another 14% come from transport. But of that combination, it's fair to say that about a third, somewhere between 30 and 40%, come from the cities overall. So overall, we are challenged very substantially by this infrastructural problem, the rigidity of our infrastructures. There's also the compression of time that we need to confront, the urgency of action to reduce our emissions, and in an emissions-constrained world, we have to find ways of changing our behaviour without throwing more resources at these particular problems. So global warming compounds existing problems and causes a multiplicity of new ones. Few are amenable to a simple spatial solution, but cities nevertheless, because of their size, their configuration, and their role in consumption, are both the source of threat but also the potential site for solutions. So how we live, and how we live in the suburbs in particular, matters a great deal. We're faced with the tyrannies of infrastructure and institutional and policy path dependency. We have to overcome the things that we have built over many decades. But first, let me talk about some solutions before we become too depressed. As I mentioned, we are subject to, we have built ourselves around, a system of water security, drawing water from distant catchments, which are at the moment pretty much in some degree of decline or a problem. Others have suggested, and here I'm beginning to draw on some of the work done by the Victorian Eco Innovations Laboratory, a very interesting program run through Melbourne University. There are alternatives, for example, black sewer mining, black water mining, sewer mining, or the retention of urban runoff, a much more localised form of water harvesting. Similarly, we are dependent on distant forms of energy and very much on coal. And yet it is possible to conceive of us transforming our cities and our suburbs to become sites of production, using geothermal perhaps for baseload, but also using solar and wind to provide us with those very important sources of peak energy which we're going to need to deal with. And similarly, when it comes to food, we can actually think about transforming our cities into what are, I think, are well known as edible landscapes. We can transform those highly concretised and sealed suburbs into things which are much more productive and much more localised and, of course, saving on energy costs associated with transport at the same time. The entire city, in fact, can be reconfigured as a result. So overall, I think that the prospect, the possibility of an alternative way of conceiving the city is this. We can think of the city as a site of diversity, dispersed production, providing us with greater resilience in distributed and localised systems. And in this sense, a retreat to the suburbs, refashioned socially and ecologically, is a good bet. So, what next? Greater urban density? Probably. And I think that Rob Adams' very important work here needs to be thought about in the situation of working within a constrained environment, constrained energy, constrained time. All of this is going to imply significant changes in cultural, economic, and regulatory behaviour. Commodified forms of production and consumption will need to be transformed. We'll have different forms of transport. We'll have different forms of employment. Having said all of that, I think it's now time to face some harsh realities. Because so far, to date, we have a heritage of institutional and policy failure in the urban domain. We're not lacking in good words, the flurry of I words in terms of ideas, invocations, incantations. But the freeway, if you like, the freeway to the ever-expanding suburbs is littered with the roadkill of good intentions, good reports, and even better plans. We've got a litany of planning failures which have marked Melbourne's and other Australian cities' development, and astonishingly, relatively little analysis of why this is so, little restraint, why we've had so little restraint on urban expansion or on population growth. So at the end of the day, I think we actually need to think about a festival implementation. This is where the chickens come back in again. Our chickens are going to come home to roost. The question we have to make, or the question we have to think about, is whether they'll be headless, or roasted, or regulated, or free range. We're confronted by the tyrannies of infrastructural, institutional, and policy dependency, and the limitations of our political systems. State governments in particular are too close to the action, in my view, too reliant on political client groups, and deeply compromised as a result. So we need not only new ideas, but new institutions and new funding. Admittedly, we're seeing new funding for solar power, for public transport, but this is still vastly offset by vastly greater funding for developments that entrench, for a very long period to come, high energy, fossil fuel use and emissions and the problems of climate change. So far, we've not seen the move towards integrative and adaptive and nimble institutions. Ones which will tie government departments and development activities together across the silos of energy and transport and housing and food and water production and also emissions reduction. There's not that integration there, and it's critically important. In terms of regulatory and planning controls, and planning is a state responsibility, we haven't seen enough brilliant innovation here. Green tracking regulations, which will provide very, very quick permits to those developers who want to go to 8 or 10-star housing or building developments, and transport planning standards. I also believe that we need much more powerful federal regulatory and fiscal intervention, both in terms of coordination and funding. Perhaps going back to something, and some of you may shudder to hear this, the DIRD, the Department of Urban and Regional Development style development or approach, which was used by the Whitlam government many decades ago. We need federal fiscal intervention to provide both carrots and sticks. The proposed state infrastructure tax is not going to be a sufficient barrier to poor development. Ironically, the carbon pollution reduction scheme, which the government is talking about, is going to allocate some $20 billion over the first 5 years of its operation to support high-emitting industries. That $20 billion should be used to rebuild our suburbs, to integrate these processes that I'm mentioning, and to recognise that cheap and affordable housing is a political driver and an economic driver for governments and politics generally. We need cheap, equitable, energy-efficient housing, and probably in full as well. And this is perhaps the way that we need to think about the suburbs into the future. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Peter. And I think that was a wonderful sketch through a range of patterns of drivers in relation to policy development. And I'd now like to turn to our second speaker, who can very nicely perhaps give us some insight into the interstices of those patterns and policy developments that Peter sketched out for us in talking very directly about building design and planning design. And so it's with great pleasure that I turn to our second speaker, Professor Philip Goad. He is the director of the Melbourne School of Design here at the University and an authority on Australian architecture and is internationally known for his research in this field. And he brings a wealth of different sorts of expertise. He's both an architect, a conservation consultant, and a curator, as well as being an expert on the life of Robin Boyd. He has a number of publications and award-winning publications to his credit. In particular, he's the author of New Directions in Australian Architecture and the co-author of New Directions in Tropical Asian Architecture. So it's really interesting to see different cultural perspectives also coming to bear, and that is something that I think might be very interesting if we can pick up, given that the festival is also about the idea of cultural change. In 2006, Philip was a co-recipient of an Australian Research Council Discovery Grant for a two-year study on healthy bodies, healthy minds, designing everyday modernism for Australian communities, 1920 to 1970. And with that, I'd like to ask Philip to come to the lectern. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee, for that introduction. For years, the Australian suburb has been alternately loved and reviled, the subject of dismal novels and searing social critique, the subject of black humour and grim realism, sentimentalised and lampooned, enshrined or simply cast out. There have been critics and commentators like George Johnston, Patrick White and John Brack, but also champions like Hugh Stretton, Patrick Troy, and architects like Edmund and Corrigan in the late 1970s and early 1980s, who controversially celebrated the ugly and ordinary of the suburbs as a place where dignity could be found in the ordinary. In painting, perhaps no one has captured this ambivalence as well as the late Howard Arkley in his luminescent, fuzzy portrayals of the icon of suburbia, the single-family house. But there's now a pressing need to reimagine the suburbs. Our cities cannot afford to keep spreading. Infinite sprawl is no longer tenable, especially when there is not the transport and services infrastructure to support growth, nor the provision of public facilities and public landscapes to create viable communities. We've tried to reimagine parts of the city before, and this image might be familiar. The results were frankly dramatic. The Housing Commission towers that ring metropolitan Melbourne were too damaging in their argument for urban change. And yet, they were undertaken with the sincere aim of social reform. And despite their obvious flaws and shortcomings, one can argue strongly that there were and still are many positive aspects to these schemes. Increased density, the provision of affordable housing, the proximity to public transport, the proximity to shopping streets and also markets, a resistance to gentrification, and the retention of a broad social and diverse ethnic mix in inner urban neighbourhoods. Now, the problem and success of the suburbs has been the resilience of the suburban ideal. And after all, what's wrong with it? A picturesquely planned single-family house with a garden. It's got home ownership, privacy. It's a veritable and manageable Arcadia. But in today's terms, one has to ask, and really I support Peter in this, can we still afford this in terms of space, energy usage, and water consumption? And does this housing form really reflect the demographic mix and needs of today's society? Now, for years we've thought that this was the case, despite the naysayers and also despite the clear and obvious presence of higher density housing types in all Australian capital cities since the 1920s. And it's been supported by writers like Robin Boyd, whose 1952 book Australia's Home, reprinted for decades and supported by a swathe of home magazines and speculative home builders marching to the horizon, all repeating the catch cry that Australia is the small house. Well, it's not anymore, and we need to wake up to the fact that our suburbs need to address the concept of density. It simply doesn't make sense to think that only the central city can support high-density residential living. It's a reality that suburbs like Camberwell will have a skyscraper or two in the future, and that's okay. At Camberwell Junction, this is the approved development, which will rise to 15 storeys. It will replace an ugly car yard, retain an historic bank, and have mixed use of shops and restaurants at ground level. But clearly, it doesn't spell the end of Camberwell and its leafy residential enclave. It doesn't raise an area of historic houses or despoil an historic streetscape. But interestingly, it doesn't contain a compulsory percentage of affordable housing. But it does mean that Melbourne might begin to think of itself as a series of urban villages. It was always founded as a series of villages, but why not a series of urban villages with nodes of, and I'd suggest we might have to think of, nodes of high density. Frankston, Box Hill, Ringwood, and yes, why not Camberwell? This, it has to be said, is one of the cornerstones of the plan of Melbourne 2030, a much discussed and in some quarters vilified plan, but a plan which was intended to actually try to halt the infinite sprawl of Melbourne. And politically, we know already, if you listen to the radio this morning, things are changing with the boundaries to our cities. But even this notion of density has to be supported by public transport and community infrastructure, supporting this idea of Melbourne being a series of urban villages. What this all means is that urban designers, planners, architects, landscape architects and developers should be rethinking the fundamental unit of the suburban subdivision, the block, and closely examining density and matching it against the continuing and dominant desire for living on the ground, having a garden and, where possible, affirming private home ownership. Density and volumetric studies like these might be a way of making change, but at a level of incremental and organic change, as opposed to the dramatic tabula rasa projects of the 1960s. We need to think of doing this carefully and in a way which actually doesn't compromise amenity. Why not, for example, consider a different housing type? Density studies such as these reveal the efficiency of the courtyard house as a new urban model. So why not look at the ancient Roman courtyard house on the left, which generally had two totally private courtyards, one of which was an impluvium. And the impluvium collected rainwater that was fed directly into a subterranean water tank. So why not? History has so many really interesting, denser housing types which we can think about. Or on the right, what of the traditional Chinese courtyard house? Again, a house with at least two courtyards, which employed clay bricks and clay roof tiles, materials all familiar to us, and which connected to the Hutong, a pedestrian-based lane network outside. And why not? Why not think of these as different ways of thinking about houses? We don't need it to immediately jump to the idea that increased density means high-rise apartment living. It's no surprise then that in Melbourne in the 1950s, the most progressive architects, when they built for themselves, designed courtyard houses. Roy Grounds' courtyard of 1953 for his house in Hill Street in Toorak was a circle covered by a canopy of deciduous vines, the focus of all the rooms of this two-bedroom house, while all windows to the outside walls were above eye height. Robin Boyd's house in South Yarra was another courtyard house, this time a brilliant rethinking of the 19th century terrace house separating parent zone from children's zone, but it could easily be two households, one on either side of the courtyard and sharing the space between, an idea of a cooperatively shared suburban garden. But it's not just the house as a typology that needs to be reimagined. And I must stress that I've just shown just one of a myriad of possible solutions to rethinking housing type. A key aspect of any suburb is its supporting network of streets, public and commercial spaces, and community facilities, that all of which really ought to be able to be walked to. So easily overlooked are the public spaces of community: the swimming pool, the football ground, the kindergarten, the baby healthcare centre, the local library. This is Brisbane's centenary pool. These are the spaces most at risk in existing suburbia, with the rush to rationalise, centralise, and in effect, demand access only by motor car. What new community on our outs and our fringes boasts such facilities? Where are the new tennis clubs, the new bowling clubs, the new local soccer field, or even the outdoor futsal pitch? That's indoor soccer. The outdoor futsal pitch, which needs only to be the size of a double garage. Why are we losing most of our public outdoor swimming pools, iconic places of socialisation and gathering? The key location in all of this, though, is the local school. It needs to be the starting point of any suburban plan. We should not start with the house, we should start with the school, which is going to be the focus of any community. In 1920, American planner Clarence Perry designated the school as the starting point for the design of any neighbourhood unit, hence community. The key was a five-minute walk for children to their elementary school. New and existing primary and secondary schools need to be rethought as new community nodes, places where open space is sacrosanct, places also where the idea and culture of a productive landscape, as Peter mentioned, might be fostered. Last year, I ran a studio with 15 Masters of Architecture students in the Melbourne School of Design, and our brief was to work in collaboration with Stephanie Alexander's Kitchen Garden Foundation and design a prototype prefabricated kitchen classroom that was sustainable in material choice, the collection of rainwater and use of energy, and it might be dropped into any school across Victoria. This project, for example, by Rob Chittleborough, involved a series of water collecting roofs atop very ordinary, inexpensive timber box forms. Another, by Katia Pelicano, uses a repetitive steel frame and a parasol roof to reduce thermal gain. The compelling aspect of all of the student projects was the whole idea of a holistic approach to education, design, and climate change, a thoroughly integrated way of promoting cultural change at grassroots level and with children and the next generation. In 2010, it will be 50 years since the publication of Robin Boyd's The Australian Ugliness. In that book, Boyd coined the two terms featureism, and I love this one, arborophobia. Featureism, the camouflaging of buildings with superfluous decoration, has been much studied and the coals of taste raked over again and again. But arborophobia, the suburban hatred, as Boyd saw it, of trees, hasn't left us. Indeed, it's still with us. It's alarming. Indeed, the role of trees in the suburbs needs new attention, not just as street trees, but as critical elements that might not only assist in providing shade, amenity, and shelter for wildlife, but also to act as productive elements of the suburban landscape. And whatever happened to the mandatory lemon tree in everyone's garden? And what about thinking about a new type of suburban orchard? The suburban landscape can be reimagined in terms of density, infrastructure, especially water and landscape. And we need to look beyond the trappings of style, which Boyd focused on, and ask other questions that relate to design but suggest fundamental rethinking of a whole range of parameters. Subdivision. Can we propose new block and street layouts that suggest a new range of housing typologies and affordable alternatives? Water. Let's legislate for residential water tanks and think more creatively how we might include the collection of water into domestic design. Space. Can we build in the spaces between two houses like these? What are the limits? Can we do this legally? And what are the barriers to overcome legislation in terms of making innovation? What are the sacrifices that we might have to make in terms of amenity? And there might need to be some sacrifices made. Solutions, I would argue, have to come through design and collaboration with a willing community to change. And that's hard. Finally, I finish again on another Howard Arkley painting. House and Garden, Western Suburbs, Melbourne, it's called, 1988. It's vibrant, colourful and full of life, as well as angst and alienation. You can't do without. And it is the space of the greatest challenge for the future of the Australian city, to reimagine these everyday landscapes as sustainable and productive, and in the minds of the community, resilient rather than vulnerable. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Philip. On a very personal note, that first slide you started with, it reminded me of my very first job with the Urban Renewal Authority here in Victoria well over 30 years ago. So it was interesting to see that. And one of the things that I personally drew out as well was the need to rethink at that design level. And as a long-time property lawyer, I think it's really interesting that you mentioned the need for legal change. And when I think that the standard block has its, and the property concept goes back to the 11th century in the UK, then perhaps it is time for some change. And I think this was a wonderful talk to stimulate those ideas. And so thank you. And I'd like to now turn to our third speaker, who is going to pick up some of these themes, but to give us an idea of the continuity of the suburb and how the historical experiences of Australia can be brought to bear on this question of cultural change. And so it's with pleasure that I turn to our third speaker, Associate Professor Andrew May. And he's an urban historian in the School of Historical Studies here at the University. He was the director of the Encyclopedia of Melbourne project and supervised its publication for a number of years. He's applied history in a number of contexts, very on-the-ground Melbourne pod tours with the ABC. And his first book, Melbourne Street Life, explored long-forgotten aspects of the 19th century public culture here in Melbourne. He also has a range of other publications that celebrate urban and suburban life. And as well as these publications, he brings a standing as sitting on a number of advisory committees, and these are important institutions within Victoria. So, for example, the National Trust, the Public Record Office for Victoria, Heritage Victoria, the State Library, the Melbourne Immigration Museum, amongst others. So there's a wealth of advice to our central institutions that Andrew is providing. In particular, more recently, the Encyclopedia of Melbourne won the 2007 Victorian Community and Local Government Award for the Best Collaborative Community Work. So there's an engagement with the community that's very important in his work and professional life. So thank you, Andrew.
Thank you for that kind introduction. I'm going to take my role this afternoon as a bit of an opportunity to reflect and expand, I think, on the cultural meanings of suburbia, and therefore, I hope, too, on some of the possibilities for cultural change, and on top of the types of sort of institutional and spatial changes that Peter and Philip have suggested. How do we create in the suburbs centres of interest, excellence and exchange? How do we make them productive? How do we give them a touch of urbanity? And in those sort of that rubric we've got for this session, sort of implicitly, I think, is a kind of a negative view, a negative appraisal, if you like, of our inherited culture of suburbia, which are, in fact, and have been for a very long time historically, our typical and ubiquitous haunt. So is this kind of line of questioning about the suburbs a kind of a hackneyed one? Does it perpetuate sort of stereotypes of monotony and disengagement and so forth? We could alternatively ask, is the suburb as our characteristic habitat, is it not already productive in many ways? Are the suburbs really lacking in urbanity? And what do we mean by that? Now, I think some of the kind of radical solutions that we're opening up, radical challenges, certainly demand some really radical rethinking. But I think they also demand of us that we do examine our histories, we reframe our assumptions, if you like, about the past that we've inherited in order to make these sort of decisions about the future. And perhaps in doing so, some of the solutions that we're thinking of may not be quite as radical as we think they are, and maybe not quite as difficult as perhaps we perceive them to be. They might more easily fit into a kind of a continuum of solutions of thought and of practice that actually have lineages that go back quite some way in our histories. That said, I think, again, as Philip pointed to, we might also reflect on the types of kind of culture clashes and clashes of practice and expectations that we face when we're trying to modify our behaviours and our expectations about urban and suburban living. We could locate the suburban past in myriad places. At various times in our history, it's been the product of both push factors and pull factors, of appeal and revulsion, of the perceived delights of a retreat to some kind of semi-rural idyll, and the rejection of a perceived inner-city blight and inner-city decay, particularly in the immediate post-war years. Australia has perhaps rightly been touted as the first suburban nation and has always been very self-consciously so. Our original suburbs date from the early decades of the 19th century, when that suburban ideal was the dominant ideology in Britain, founded on notions of domestic privacy, of bourgeois conservatism and conformity, of religious virtue, the home as the kind of sanctuary, on sanitary and environmental kind of wholesomeness. Of course, railway growth from the 1880s particularly, and the motor car from the post-1950s, led that kind of outer suburban expansion. The crash of the 1890s and the demise of those great land boomers of the 1880s perhaps also marked the kind of roots of some of that anti-suburban sentiment that we've also already mentioned. And that was nourished too by other international trends, by scepticism for suburbia that was being promulgated in Britain, for example, by H.G. Wells and other authors in the early decades of the 20th century. Was the suburb a retreat from the city, or was it a retreat from life itself? Now, this image of the suburb of the past, if you like, represented on the cover of Australian Home Beautiful in December 1953, with that sign saying, "To Better Living," captures in freeze frame, I think, some of these tensions and aspirations at a critical period of the suburb's development. Over the post-war period, a massive period of transition that it was, saw this suburban frontier expand and consolidate. Both conservative and radical critics alike have constructed the suburb at different times as a bastion of conformity, where a generation of Australian intellectuals perhaps despised suburbia for its perceived mediocrity and conformity. Robert Menzies, for example, placed the suburban home squarely in the forefront of Liberal Party ideology in the 1940s. Quote, "That one little piece of earth with a house and garden which is ours, to which we can withdraw, in which we can be amongst our friends, and into which no stranger can come against our will." Now, it's through interviewing suburban pioneers, as numbers of historians call them, historians such as Graham Davison and John Murphy and others, have started to kind of revise the sneering and patronising view of the suburbs and instead asserting a place through these decades where men and women were living much more complex and nuanced lives, where the meanings of public and private, of home and domesticity, isolation, freedom, progress, triumphing over adversity, were all experienced in very real and different ways. And the suburbs of our histories are places that are brim full of meaning and expectation for everyday people. These sorts of intimate social and cultural histories of Australia, and Australian suburbia particularly, are still really crying out to be resurrected and written. But the headline history of suburbia is still, I think, very much derived from the twin fictions of the novelist Penn, and perhaps to a great extent too by a kind of baby boomer nostalgia about the suburb that we've seen particularly from the 1990s. Now, a lot of the novelist caricatures of the suburb are drawn with specific purposes and premises in mind. On the cusp of the 1950s, for example, socialist writer John Morrison's 1949 novel, The Creeping City, suspiciously viewed Melbourne creeping out towards the Dandenongs as this kind of conformist, upstart, upper-class city marching out, where wattles were replaced by roses in gardens, and I quote, that succumbed to the tractable paraphernalia of Toorak and South Yarra. So this kind of suburb as a contested cultural domain is quite clear. There's no doubt that this sense of the creeping city was very contested as these older, more rural areas were succumbing to residential incursion. The fruit and the flower growing districts and the agricultural districts of the 1940s becoming the suburban villages of the 1950s. And this is where Boyd's arborophobes, of course, fit in. So this creeping city of Morrison resonates with tension, resentment, the city versus the country, the wealthy suburban newcomers invading a land that's already been claimed by a previous generation of residents and settlers, the street imposed on the bush, Indigenous flora supplanted by exotic. And by implication, that new suburbanite was superficial and self-possessed, preferring to clean the slate and favouring a standardisation of landscape. While popular imagery of suburbia is often negative, individual suburbanites will consistently affirm the positive aspects of their lifestyle in everyday ways. Much of the physical and institutional landscape of the post-war suburb is the legacy of that immediate post-war idealism, galvanised by the pursuit of common goals, inspired by post-war dreams of privacy, home ownership, a better environment to bring up a new generation. And the stories those pioneer suburbanites will tell you about the way they battled to make good on that suburban frontier comprise a great foundation mythology and story. The suburb is made much more complex if we observe the ways that people empower their own memories in reminiscence about exactly what's happened. With a gleam in their eye, they'll tell you their personal histories, how they killed five snakes digging in the driveway, how they used to burn Kero and sump oil in the gutters to get rid of the mosquitoes, how women pushed their prams for miles along rutted, unmade roads to get to the shops, how men who've never been handy in their lives suddenly turned their hand to all manner of tasks. The legitimacy of this suburb might be vouched for in more positive ways, turning the uncertainties and mistakes of the past into future prospects and possibilities. The boom middle suburbs that experienced their demographic peaks in the 60s and 1970s were, perhaps by the start of this century, being spurned for cheaper land on the urban fringe or the apparent convenience and cosmopolitan delight of the inner city. But these discomforting and unrewarding stereotypes of suburbia are still very much naggingly lodged in our everyday consciousness. Suburbia can still be characterised, and is constantly so, and I quote from a recent newspaper, as synonymous with blandness, row upon row of cookie-cutty houses along identical streets in neighbourhoods seemingly devoid of anything interesting to see or do. So that black and white stereotype of suburbia still haunts the way we see the city in the present. And we also need to be on the watch for these kind of sepia-toned elements of nostalgia. While suburbia is, on the one hand, the focus of a kind of intellectual scorn, on the other, it also can be represented as a very idealised place, replete with innocent and familiar and comfortable images. The 50s very much became retro in the 90s, defended against fashionable criticisms for their blandness. As Janet McCalman, the historian, has pointed out, the tropes of the baby boomers are backyards in Melbourne, the beach in Sydney, Hills hoists, Holden cars, mums in the kitchen, dads in the tool shed, grandma still in the inner suburbs, where real life goes on. The nostalgic version of the suburb has it as the way it ought to be, clean, quiet, natural, domestic places. It was a time, supposedly, when you could leave the front door open on a hot night, when daughters could walk home late at night, safe and unmolested. So again, I think we need to account in our analyses for the role of nostalgia in forming our understandings of suburban and community life. Some aspects have been lost because they never existed. Some have been lost because they were probably worth losing. Some now take place in other locations, in virtual spaces, and some are still with us. Suburban histories can recover these moments when individuals look ahead, perched unsure and self-consciously on the threshold between past and future, themselves sometimes nostalgic for an idealised past. As she stood on Doncaster Hill in the mid-1950s, Jean Field, the writer, looked ahead and looked behind. In the face of what she saw as the rampant materialism and greed of land speculators and developers, she questioned the uniformity of building design, the homogenous physical and moral direction of Melbourne's sprawl. "We might profit today," she wrote, "if we could bring ourselves to shed some of the luxuries of modern living and return to the simple things once again." But that post-war suburban push was irrepressible. Land was cheaper, more available. And as the Argus newspaper trumpeted in May 1950, "The air is fresher out there and it's a good place to raise a family, away from the heavy traffic and the congested shopping areas. It's healthier," the young mothers will tell you. "In fact, for the first few weeks, you'll find yourself eating like a horse." Now, I love this image of Cole's New World. I think it's in North Balwyn, perhaps around 1960. It's a picture from the past, but it tells us something about the way we've tended to look to the future for confidence, for ideas, for inspiration. It's an image, too, perhaps, that looks very dated. How much the world has changed since car parking spaces for 300 and automatically opening doors were a novelty. We can't plan the future, that is, we can't anticipate the things that we don't know about it. Historian Mark Peel has noted in his History of Elizabeth in South Australia, "Historians of Australian planning tend to stress the powerlessness of the reformers and the visionaries. Their characters limp rather forlornly across a landscape of torn up plans and broken designs, able to deflect but never to finally shape the form of Australian cities." When we look at this past, we often regretfully say, "Why didn't we?" But I don't think in any way that means that we shouldn't still be looking to the future and still asking, why can't we do different things? My last picture is about the suburb imagined. We're forever standing by this backyard fence, either straining to catch a glimpse through the spy hole into the past or looking through the crack into the future. Can we first feel at home in the suburbia that we've inherited? Can the suburb be more comfortable with its past? Can we see a future less as a community of exclusion than an interactive and sustainable human setting? The experiences of individual suburban residents, pioneers and their inheritors, mistrusted by intellectual elites, need in some respects to find new legitimacy. To redeem the suburb, which I take to mean to reclaim it, to get it back, to rescue it, to reimagine it, firstly, it means, I think, to recognise it, to admit that we're actually at home in it, to feel at home in it, to perhaps even feel proud of it. Our own imagination of what it can become needs to be shaped by an understanding of what it's actually been. Everyday experiences of social life might be analysed in terms of change and transformation rather than as decline. In thinking about what Peter's called the edible landscape, we can learn, as he mentions, from Andrea Gaynor's work on the way that that suburban residents have, in fact, had a very strong and rich history of growing food. An assumed loss of community in contemporary suburban life, a loss of social capital, is much characterised by suburban critics. But these stereotypes ignore the suburb's historical and future capacity to accommodate cultural change. And many historians are now starting to look at the history of the suburbs as sites of engagement rather than detachment through the 1950s and beyond. With the opening in late 1956 of the Cafe Harver in the Midway Arcade in Ringwood, replete with a new espresso coffee machine and continental cakes, the Ringwood Mail could proudly assert that the march of progress charged through Ringwood in seven-leg boots. There's a top of Collins Street air about its shops, offices and little salons, which for colour, design and contemporary fixings would be hard to beat. What is urbanity? The quality of being urbane, civilised, townish, refined, cultured? It is simplistic to think it's about whether you can get a cafe latte or not. It's been argued that the imposition of conformity by the few on the many leads to a denial of social and environmental diversity. This pressure to conform is the kind of key motif of suburbia. But if I've made one point this afternoon, it's to say that the instinct to contest, to innovate and adapt is very much the liberating corollary of suburbia. "Don't be one of these," chided the Argus in 1950, "the man who refuses to cut his nature strip so it stands as an untidy blot in an otherwise trim street, who allows weeds to grow and garden rubbish to accumulate in his backyard, who plants one of those annoying trees or hedges which scatter their seeds all over the neighbourhood, who covers the dividing fence with an untidy creeper, or worst of all, keeps fowls and allows them to stray next door." Yet there's always slippage between the protocol and the practice. Looking back on 2009 from the future, we might easily presume that all motorists travel at 50 kilometres an hour in local streets, which they don't. In the same way, the observer of the suburbs should be alert to all manner of subversions and of any presumed suburban monotony and standardisation. Changes in attitudes and behaviour can be read over long periods of time with a greater eye for why particular issues are important at different times. The planting of nature strips with native grasses was an untidy blot on the landscape in the 1950s, certainly in decried as a weed heap and a fire hazard up to the 1980s and 90s. But perhaps that sort of practice is becoming much more de rigueur in the 21st century. Peter mentioned the importance of federal government regulatory intervention. I think so much about the landscape, the localised landscape of suburbs, is also invigilated by a regulatory regime of local government that's very much inherited from those immediate post-war years that reacted against these perceived evils of obstruction and diversity and noise and so on. So like Scrooge in Dickens' A Christmas Carol, who undergoes a profound process of redemption, we should be haunted by these ghosts of the past, the present, as well as the future yet to come, if we are to redeem the suburb and the city. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I think that is a wonderful note to end our presentations on, that if we have the source of redemption for Australian life in our suburbs, if it's not modern monotony, if we have that chance to question, to reimagine, then I think that's an important note that Andrew has given us to start our discussion. And what I would like to do, I think, is open up for questions in a moment, and I will remind you that this session is being recorded, so when we do go to questions, if you wouldn't mind speaking clearly, and we do have roving mics to assist that process. But I guess I'd like to just do a quick go through the three speakers and say one thing that you think needs to be changed, reimagined in relation to climate change if we are to redeem the suburb. So we'll start maybe with Andrew first.
I think that's a
one.
Fantastic. And one thing. I think one of the keys is to address the kind of fictions we tell ourselves. We're very informed. We've had a lot of experience. We have a lot of advice, but we have a lot of fictional narratives to explain to ourselves the way that suburban life and city life operates. One statistic I learned recently was, for example, there were more road accident deaths in Australia almost twice as many over the course of the 20th century than all the Australians killed in all the wars in the 20th century, which is an extraordinary way of kind of turning around some of these assumptions we have about the prices we're prepared to pay for the sort of lifestyle that we enjoy. So if there's one thing, it's about actually convincing ourselves that some of these prices that we're prepared to pay are real or not. And then that, I think, can galvanise us into actually more radical and immediate responses.
Good, thank you. Perhaps someone in the audience might like to take that up too in terms of reassessing fictions. And Philip?
It's a difficult question. Mm. Just one. I'm going to have two.
Yeah, all right, okay.
I think one thing, in terms of climate change in the suburbs, it would be great if we could rethink suburbia. And if, after all, the word is suburb, so it's sort of under city. So, but if you were to think about it as having what Andrew was talking about, this idea of urbanity, that walking, if you could walk to your shop, your school, your local library, how would we redesign the outer fringes with that in mind just now? And that doesn't mean you need to change your housing type also, necessarily, but just walking. And the second would be one of the key aspects of climate change and the suburb is the intrinsic nature of house and garden, and to never lose that. I mean, it's one of its suburbia's great strengths. So how do you actually keep house and landscape, and is it a 1 + 1 = 500 in terms of this idea of house and landscape? It's what makes suburbia. And the two can work together, house and landscape, to provide fantastic solutions in terms of climate change.
Good, thank you very much. And Peter, please.
Well, if he can have two, I'm going to have two. I mean, firstly, I'd emphasise that issue that I was trying to bring up about the suburb being productive. I think without an enormous effort, but using considerable funds and incentives, we can make the suburbs very productive in terms of energy, in terms of renewable energy, and much more self-sufficient in terms of both water and food. So I think that's a framework to operate to. But the other thing I think we need to do is to make that achievable and palatable. We do need to engage in a very substantial form of public education to make it a recognisable issue. At this point in time, I think there's a broad recognition that this is a concern, but it's a distant one, it's a vague one, and without that sort of deeply embedded local community-based support, no amount of regulation, no amount of assistance is actually going to achieve that outcome.
Good, thank you. Okay, well, with those three sort of, well, five, I think, points, could we open up to questions, please? And yes, okay, so I think way up the back was first, 1, 2, 3, and if we could have the mic there, thank you.
Suburban life revolves very much around automobiles. And automobiles are a major source of greenhouse gas emissions around the world. There are now close to 1 billion cars in the world. China and India are now becoming very enamored of the automobile. And in redeeming the suburb, how are we going to address this problem of not necessarily doing away with the suburb, but perhaps reducing the use of motor vehicles and relying more and more on mass transportation as well as bicycling, walking. So I was wondering if the panelists could address that because I think it's a very important factor in looking at climate change.
Good. So we need to think about redeeming the car or transport as well. So perhaps could we open it up? Who'd like to comment, please? I think perhaps Philip first up.
I think your question is an extremely pertinent one, which relates back to my response about walking. It means that we're never going to do away with the motor car completely, but what we should try and do is, as you're implying, try and reduce our reliance upon it. And whether that means, and it does mean, an increased attention to public transport infrastructure in terms of trains, trams, buses, but also the encouragement of people to use bicycles. But it's a whole community attitude, I think, that has to also be changed in terms of how really necessary is the use of the motor car for everyday activities like shopping. Do you really need to do it in terms of using the motor car to do those simple activities. And it has to do with proximity and redesigning those essential ideas to do with proximity. So from house to shopping centre, from house to major transport interchange where you can go to work. Do we actually encourage more people to actually work from home? There's a myriad of possibilities to actually try and reduce the use of the motor car. Not one magic solution, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm. Peter, did you want to have a quick comment? Or
just a quick additional comment, I suppose. I absolutely agree with what Philip's saying. It's a very complex issue, partly to do with reconfiguring social relations and work relations in particular. But one thing's very clear, that we simply can't expect people to move from the car to an alternative that doesn't exist. And at this point in time, we need a very substantial transitional program to provide those alternatives. So if, for example, we are to rely on public transport, then we have to have that alternative there before jacking up petrol prices or before raising other forms of regulatory impost, which will generally not go down very well politically at all. So the emphasis really has to be in a staged and very carefully planned transformation, of which investing in public transport clearly would be one component.
I think that notion of you know, there's a combination of things. There are disincentives by way of, you know, fuel taxes or otherwise. There are incentives to do with hybrid vehicles, to do with carpooling and so on. But I think that kind of localising sphere of it is very important. And we haven't really embraced some of the design, local issues. I mean, I know overseas there are many kind of concepts of sort of shared street spaces, the kind of Woonerf, the Dutch model, shared spaces in the UK, where bicycles and pedestrians have legal priority over cars in some local streets. And with Philip's idea of the school as the kind of hub of the neighbourhood, we've really got a long way to go from putting a few speed humps in to actually making the pace of public life at that local level mean that people are actually interacting more, and that's another key to it. You know, when you slow down, you actually have eye contact with people, and when you have eye contact with people, you actually have to negotiate more. All these other complex issues about how we relate to neighbours, to strangers and so on. So there's a whole new kind of ecosystem that we really haven't trialled in public space like that.
Yeah. Good, thank you. That issue of public space is a really important one, isn't it, that has been picked up in a number of the presentations. I think we had a question over this side next, please.
Discussion to date has not addressed the question of the change in housing needed as people change in their ages. If you look around any of the older suburbs, you find that by and large, they are underutilized. And in many cases, people, where they talk of retirement villages as people get older, they're out in whoop whoop. Now, having arrived in that age, I don't want to live in whoop whoop. And I don't see where there is any government policy which addresses this question, and particularly ties it into the kind of facilities, and including university facilities. Could you comment?
Good, thank you. So an idea of a life cycle putting in with cultural change, and so who on the panel would like to take that one first, please?
Well, I can just make a very quick comment. I mean, clearly there is some trend towards a greater investment in community and support. But I think that trend needs to be greatly enhanced, both in terms of assistance and the idea that people who become, as they become more elderly, should be supported to remain at home and within the communities that they are familiar with. That's a significant trend that's beginning to emerge in welfare thinking. But there's a range of other forms of support that also need to be required. I think that we're at a very early stage, and as the baby boomers now sort of move towards that particular moment in their lives, I think that trend in policy is going to be strengthened considerably.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Philip, please.
Yeah, I think your question is right on the money, because it comes back to the idea of designing for long life, and many of our houses are not designed for long life or changing life. And it means that your everyday speculative house plan often has no provision for the complexities of a long-term family growth, change and moving on. And it's one of those things too where if one thinks about suburbs as potentially urban villages, that they're, you would want to, if you had been there for, in the same suburb for 20 years, there's no reason why you shouldn't stay there for the next 50 years. But in terms of the possibilities of other housing types in the same location, there's just no choice. And this is part of the problem, is that the housing types available, they're often not there for the older members of the community. And this is where I think, if one was, we heard Rob Adams this morning talking about potentially densifying public transport arteries, there would, if that was to happen, that, and by that I mean he was suggesting that one would might build medium density housing along tram lines. Therefore, if you're older and less mobile, those are the sort of apartments to move into. And so the whole suburban network has a long life sort of expectancy. But your question is absolutely right, I think. And the space of the suburbs allows, I think, people to think of the granny flat perhaps is a reality. I mean, as an example, I've just built a separate building in our back garden. And it's for my eldest son, but it could be for my parents or my wife's parents. I mean, you know, these are the sort of possibilities that we need to be thinking about, and that legislation might allow that sort of thing to happen.
In the interest of getting as many questions through as possible, I might move. I think there was a question up the back. Thank you. That was the third one. Yes, thank you.
Andrew, you mentioned things about like a sort of a culture of the suburbs, real or imagined and so on. What I was interested in is, do you, any of you, the panel, think that there's any contradiction between the heritage controls, which are part of sustaining a culture, and a sustainable or a reimagined city? And in particular, I'm thinking of things like the planning scheme, the Planning Act, and the heritage controls, whether they might mitigate against a reimagining of the city in terms of sustainability, keeping in mind that culture is something you might want to sustain. Does any of the panel have any thoughts on that?
Andrew?
Well, I think, heritage is in some ways, although it's a very prescribed concept, it's also a very kind of discretionary and movable concept over time. And I think those negotiations always take place very sort of intimately in a practical way when heritage issues are being sort of debated. And I suppose maybe that's one of those silos that Peter was talking about as well, that might mitigate against some of these new ways of thinking, absolutely. And perhaps that's something that that does need to be short-circuited in a sense. But there are kind of key values that we have, and heritage is one of them, that make cities meaningful cultural, social places. But yes, at the extreme, absolutely, there could be ways that very strict interpretations or otherwise of heritage can actually keep a bit of a rein on some other ideas that might more productively take us forward. It's always a tension.
Anyone else want to comment just quickly, and then we've got some questions down the front.
Yeah. No. Look, I think it's you're absolutely right. Again, heritage is a fantastic gauge of community values, and at the same time, a fantastic way, I think, of thinking about, and it refers back to Andrew's answer to the previous question about an idea of a slower urbanism. We talk about slow cooking, but perhaps we should be talking about slow urbanism. And I think heritage was one of those ideas where the community actually comes together and makes a community decision about what is worthwhile in the built environment. And those listening to those messages, I think, are extremely important for the way cities can plan growth more carefully. But certainly it's a mitigator.
Perhaps we need a slow urbanism cookbook or something we could put together as part of the Festival of Ideas. I'm not sure who was first here, but I think perhaps at the back of these two here.
I was wondering how the rest of non-Melbourne Victoria fits into the picture with regards to the towns and rural cities are actually urban environments as well. And also in the context of public transport in those types of communities and how you could encourage that type of activity.
Thank you very much for that. I think
he
I might throw that.
Question because he wasn't using the mic.
Oh, okay, sorry.
All right, just talking about.
Talking about non-Melbourne environments and looking at towns and cities as urban entities in themselves and how they would fit into a Victorian model and that they could actually offer a different type of alternative with, with respect to public transport as well.
So picking up that sea change, tree change phenomenon and looking at the role of regional cities. I think I might throw that out to Peter first, given those were some of the issues he canvassed.
Thanks. So. Look, I think it's a very difficult answer, a difficult question to answer in some senses because of the range of towns that you might want to consider in terms of the rural. If you're thinking about large urban centres like Ballarat and Bendigo, for example, then clearly there are significant issues there, which are similar issues to the ones that you would apply to Melbourne or the Greater Melbourne in terms of how things should be developed or redeveloped and the sort of constraints and opportunities that should be provided. When you go beyond that to much smaller rural towns and settlements, I think that the pressures that they place on the environment are much, much less. And so I think that the constraints on them probably ought to be somewhat less as well. And the difficulties of servicing them effectively are much greater. So I'm not quite sure how one answers your question. Certainly there's been a tendency towards planning for nodal development and for trying to integrate population growth. And I have real problems with the issue of population growth. But in any case, while we are trying to settle larger communities and populations within Australia and within cities like Melbourne, the development of nodal communities which are very tightly integrated and very well serviced using public transport, but also all the other facilities that one would expect to have in place in terms of energy use, water and so on and so forth, is very important. So you need to focus significant resources on that sort of development. Beyond that, I'm not sure what the answer would really be, and I think that there are some real issues of both equity and opportunity when you get beyond those major settlements.
Yes, look, I think, because we've got a few more hands coming up, so I think the next person was sitting here in the front, and if you could use the mic, please.
My question relates to, I think, what you were just about to touch on there, which was population growth and the importance of how that will figure into planning, because, I've actually been to the last three lectures, and it hasn't actually been raised yet, we've got the federal government giving out a baby bonus in a country where we're struggling to supply our water needs and meet a lot of other infrastructure problems that are yet to truly be solved. How do those sort of issues, do you think, play into what your visions are, and do you see there being a need to draw a line in the sand for those type of issues and focus on that?
Okay, so on that question of the roll in of population to these issues of the suburb. Would anyone like to take that?
Don't see if we've got an answer to it, have we?
Philip, I think you're on the
end. I'll try and answer it. It's a very troubled issue, population growth, particularly in Australia, I think. I recall Philip Drew's book, The Coast Dwellers, where he was encouraging to stop population growth and for Australians to actually just sort of huddle at the edges of the continent. And in some respects, if one is gloomy, that's perhaps what we ought to do. And certainly if you're living in Adelaide, you might be a little worried as the city is starting to shrink. But other country centres in Victoria are growing.
When I say population growth, I don't mean you could cap Melbourne at a certain figure and then say let's grow the others now.
Population distribution.
Distribution, I mean, yeah. Absolutely. Now I get your picture, and now I'm happy to answer. Let's say from Melbourne example, yes, we should draw a line around and stop thinking about spread. And certainly we should be on a broader planning level, taking up what Peter was talking about at the very beginning of today's session, is to think about other centres where if there is pressure on growth, where might be other attention be put. And is it Albury, Wodonga, is it Bairnsdale, is it places which are, and it has to do with water as well and available resources. So I think there needs to be a much broader strategy about population distribution than we've ever thought about before. I mean, I think it's a huge issue.
Although I must admit, remembering back to DIRD, I think that had done some resonances there with that early policy there with DIRD. If I can just exercise some discretion in respect of our festival organiser, Patrick McCackie, I think, who had a question?
I do.
Without causing offence to our distinguished panel, I'd like to ask both Philip Goad and Peter Christoph first. I loved all that you said, but the only sign we saw of any change was that great blue whale about to swallow the little bank at Camberwell Junction in terms of all the change that you want to bring about. I saw lovely drawings of gardens growing in suburban streets, but I haven't seen any of those streets. And I remain sceptical of Andrew's version that the suburbs aren't all that bad. I am your geographical snob, which regards that a night out in Glen Waverley is not as good as a night out in the centre of Melbourne. Now, what I really want to know is that one of the curious things at present is that Monash University is now virtually in the dead centre of the population of Melbourne. Now, there could be a great cultural centre. It's not. Monash remains a kind of geographical impossibility. Nobody goes to things at Monash. You could never hold a festival of ideas there. Now, it may be...
You would say that, wouldn't you?
I know. It may be because of the stupefying ugliness of Monash's university. But I want to know... I see no signs of the evidence of what you're talking about, except for Camberwell Junction. And I really think, Andrew, you're going to go a long way to tell me. I mean, have you ever been stranded on Springvale Road? It is a new desert. There is nothing there. And when we talk about giving you a bounty, I think we've got to move much more dramatically than we have. And I see no evidence of what you're aspiring to do.
Thank you. And I think we have a devil's advocate here. Sirs, perhaps a very, very quick response, because I would like to have some further time, and I think we're almost at the end of the session.
My quick response would be, unfortunately, there are people at Monash saying exactly the same thing that you're saying right now as we speak about us. The city is multinodal, and I guess that's again feeding into this notion of what we're trying to imagine, I think, is stripping that down even more into sort of the urban village concept. But Melbourne is a whole series of different cities within the city. The other thing about the good night out in and where you go, well, I guess that's what I was pointing to some of the work of historians who are looking at associational life. We don't just physically have to go somewhere. We engage in public life. We develop this sort of social capital in lots of different ways, in virtual ways, in associational ways that transcend spatial boundaries. And that, again, has a long history.
Good. Thank you, Andrew. I think Peter wants to have a sort of a 20-second and then...
I'm very grateful for that intervention. Look, I think you're absolutely right. The point I was trying to make was that whatever we think about where we're going with the suburbs, they ain't going to stay the way they are at the moment. And in fact, climate change is an overarching narrative. It makes it very, very clear they're going to have to be substantial reorganisations. I absolutely agree with you that those are very pretty pictures, and I was trying to make the point about them, and perhaps also about Philip's vision for Camberwell. Those opportunities and those visions for the future will only occur if we have very substantial institutional change based on a clear-sighted understanding that unless we reduce emissions, reduce our water use, and plan very differently in a very short period of time, we will have a much worse alternative. So those are utopian visions unless we have the institutional change, in particular the regulatory and the funding capacities to drive that change. And I think that change won't come from within the states. I think the states are too politically compromised for a range of reasons to actually achieve them.
One last question by someone who's been very patient, and perhaps some of the points, if the panel doesn't mind, some points people can perhaps pick up after the formal close of the session. Thank you.
I'd like to introduce my question by saying that I was a student in this university in 1944. And I can't altogether agree with Patrick by saying that Monash is dreadful when you have a look at what's happened to the beautiful gardens of this university. I used to play hockey where this building Yes. Might I say this, that I don't think any of us are really looking at... We're looking at Melbourne as we see it in the centre. But Melbourne grew as a city from the gold that was mined in Ballarat and Bendigo. And Melbourne is a city that has a four-state hinterland. South Australia, half of New South Wales, Victoria and Tasmania. So it's not a city with close urban boundaries. In 1978, the Westgate Bridge was rebuilt. Since that time, almost as many people live in the western arc of Port Phillip, which encompasses Geelong, Ballarat, Bendigo, with a population that's almost as large as Brisbane or Adelaide. So what we're talking about, the need is to transfer to multi-centre cities of a big socio-economic city in continental Australia. I'd like your comment about that.
I think we just have one panel member comment here in the interest finishing up on time.
Yeah. I think, again, you're absolutely right. It's a bit like if you go to Boston, the population of Boston is probably just over half a million, but the greater Boston, it's so much more. And that's essentially what you're implying. And yes, we should have a very fast train down to Geelong, or faster, and the same goes to Bendigo, Ballarat, and so that the network is much, much more interrelated to the west particularly. And I'd agree. That's far-sighted planning.
That's what has to be done
now. Yeah.
Good. Thank you. And I think on that final note, that's what has to be done now might be the way we finish our session. And if you could join me in thanking our speakers and for your participation.